In July of last year, Ashley Hale Smith was driving home from work when she witnessed a horrible accident. That's when she sprang into action. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Every year, Heroes of the Heartland are recognized by the Red Cross of Greater Iowa for acts of heroism or community service. This hour, we'll hear a few of their stories, including that of fourth grader Josh Little, who saved a classmate from choking, Baxter police officer Joe Bartello, who helped rescue a truck driver submerged in floodwater, a man who pushed a car out of the way of an oncoming train, and we remember Officer Jamie Bunting, who was shot and killed in the line of duty. Heroes of the Heartland, after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our focus today, the American Red Cross 2014 Heroes of the Heartland. Ordinary people who've done extraordinary things that can inspire us. This hour, we're finding out about the stories behind some of this year's heroes. In November of 2012, unimaginable tragedy struck the family of Tony Pearson and Kim Kraft of Lake City. That's a community of about 1,700 just west of Fort Dodge. While Tony and Kim were working an overnight shift, an electrical fire destroyed their home. It claimed the lives of their children, 8-year-old Madison, 3-year-old Wyatt, as well as a 10-month-old grandson, Xavier, and 22-year-old Tyra. The morning following the fire, local businessman Gus Mackey and his daughter-in-law, Chrissy, provided the parents an entire home, rent-free, for as long as necessary. The Mackeys also reached out to the community and to the media to collect furniture and clothing. Gus Mackey joins us. He's the owner of Mackey Motors in Lake City, Iowa. Gus Mackey, welcome to our program, and congratulations as a 2014 Hero of the Heartland.
Well, thank you.
How did you find out about the fire?
I knew Tony. He's the age of my sons, and he was Tony Barthman then. He changed his name to Pearson. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the day after the fire, he came walking in the store. He acted shocked. All of a sudden, it dawned on me that the people that we had the tragedy were people that I've known since he was a little kid. And then I thought, oh, God, this is terrible. And so I just have to do what I have to do to help them. Mm-hmm. They didn't have anywhere to turn. Every single thing they had burned up. Every possession they had burned up, and their family burned up. And so I thought, oh, boy, I'm blessed with some stuff, so I just have to help this family.
What sort of conversation, it must have been incredibly difficult, did you have with Tony and Kim?
It was incredibly difficult. There was a lot of sobbing. As it progressed, it just got worse and worse. And I just was not believing what I was hearing, and I thought, oh, this probably just can't happen. I've lived in Lake City since 1971, and this is by far the worst thing that ever happened in our town. This is the worst thing I ever heard happen anywhere. So I said, what I can do to help, I'm going to do right now.
Mm-hmm. You and your daughter-in-law allowed them to grieve their tremendous loss without having to worry about some immediate needs. Not only offering a house rent-free for as long as necessary, but you reached out to the community for what sorts of things?
Well, at 3:30 in the afternoon, I went on the local radio station, and by now everybody was talking about the fire. And I went on the Carroll radio station and said, I need clothing. I need, the house is empty. We need furniture. We need food. We need everything that we can get. I'm going to tell you that the response was so overwhelming. At 6:30 in the afternoon, 3 hours later, I went back on the radio and said, quit bringing stuff. We have 6 of everything. We had 6 microwaves. We had multiple kitchen sets. The house was furnished, had a completely furnished basement, too. So the first set of furniture that came, and pretty soon a better set of furniture showed up. So we moved the first set down in the basement, and then the food, the clothes, everything was overwhelming. The money, everything.
I wonder how, past getting together and furnishing this house for Tony and Kim to live in. What has it done to your community? It must have changed a feeling, I can imagine.
Obviously, people were deeply saddened by the tragedy, and you're right. It pulled people together. The cash donations started coming in, and I wanted to closely monitor that money, so none of us slipped through the cracks. And the donations came anywhere from $1 to $1,000, and just kept coming and coming. And pretty soon, Channel 8 News, Angie Hunt worked for Channel 8 at the time, and she was from Lake City. So she showed up and did a story for the news, and that reached out to a lot of people. Then it got pretty emotional. So pretty soon, here were all the other TV stations. And I thought, I realized that the more I was on the radio or the TV, the more, money I was collecting for these folks. Because everybody knows me better than they know Tony because of, all the advertising and everything that we do. And so, it just grew and grew. And then pretty soon the Sioux City radio or TV station showed up, and the thing became overwhelming. There were some days. That so many deposits, so much money came in that Chrissy, my daughter-in-law, spent the whole day just making deposits.
Do you have a total as of to date? What was donated for the family?
It was over 70,000.
Mm.
Yeah, one day I said, geez, I think we're going to get to 35,000, and then all of a sudden it just kept coming and coming, and it went over 70,000.
How are Tony and Kim doing now? November of 2012 was the day of the tragedy, losing four members of their family, the children. How are Tony and Kim holding up these days?
I would not say too well.
Mm. Are they still living in the house that you
provided? Yeah, the house is theirs now, mortgage-free. Yeah, it is their house now. There's no mortgage on it, and we gave them the house. And, obviously that's a tragedy when you lose a family like that. And when all the people leave and the media leaves and everything and you're by yourself and then the reality sets in, it's horrible. And they put the money in a trust account, and they're very careful with the cash. And because obviously they weren't used to, having that kind of a balance. And that part is fine. The home is beautiful. They have clothes. They have they have food. They have everything they need, but they don't have their family.
No, nothing can be more devastating than the loss of children. But in talking with them, do you get a sense of what the difference the community support has made to them, not only in the money, but the action, the caring, what difference it has made to at least somewhat lessen the impact of this?
I think they were overwhelmed. I know they were overwhelmed by it.
I wonder, Gus Mackey, you and your daughter-in-law, Chrissy Mackey, are being honored as 2014 Heroes of the Heartland. I wonder, Gus Mackey, how has this changed you and your daughter-in-law?
No, I don't think it changed me. Like I say, we've did real good. When people need help, I help them.
Mm. Gus Mackey. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations as a hero of the Heartland from the Red Cross.
All right, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our focus today, the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa 2014 Heroes of the Heartland. These are ordinary people who've done extraordinary things. This hour, we're finding out about the stories behind some of this year's heroes. Last May, Baxter police officer Joe Bartello got a call to assist Jasper County Sheriff Deputy Jeremy Burdess. He was at the scene of an accident. A 70-year-old truck driver, Dwayne Michael, had been injured, and he was trapped inside his vehicle after crashing along Interstate 80 due to flood water. Together with Deputy Burdess and the Newton police officer, Adam Herman, the three saved Mr. Michael, who, despite some bruised ribs, some cuts, and some soreness, survive the ordeal. This past March, the three were honored as Heroes of the Heartland by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa. Officer Joe Bartello joins us now by phone from his home in Baxter. Officer Bartello, thank you for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you start off by describing the scene when you arrived? It's quite late on that Thursday night. I guess it's early Friday morning, 2 in the morning, something like that?
Yeah, it was pretty close to 2 o'clock in the morning. I arrived on scene. The semi-trailer had actually driven in between, in the median area, in between the two bridges on I-80. And when you get there, it's pretty difficult to see. But from the bridge, I hollered down. Deputy Burdess and Officer Herman were already on scene. They were already in the water on top of the cab and trying to communicate with Michael inside. I just ran down there and asked them what they needed. They were looking for a window punch to try and break out one of the windows.
So this semi-tractor trailer, the cab was, this is upright. It wasn't turned over. It was upright, but in a large pool of water.
Correct. It was almost fully submerged. The whole trailer end of the semi was up on the bank and shoreline, and the actual truck was just about fully submerged in about 12 feet of water. Just the very upper portion, about a foot or 2 feet of the sleeper area, was actually popped out and was above the surface of the water. It actually stopped right about in the middle of the creek in the flood water. So I do believe it was submerged, but it looked like maybe the front end was leaned against one of the pylons holding up the bridge.
Mm-hmm. So you scrambled down there to assist Deputy Burdess and Officer Herman. When you arrived, what did you determine was the plan of action? It was urgent, critical that you get him out, right?
Yeah. We didn't really know how long he'd been in there. Communication with him was very minimal. Deputy Burdess was actually on top of the cab, the portion that was out of the water, and was trying to communicate through the roofing of the cab with Dwayne. Officer Herman was next to the driver's side door. The window was actually cracked a little bit, and he could reach his hand through and was at times holding on to Dwayne's hand. They were trying to ask him, you know, how long he'd been there, if he had any injuries, if he was stuck on anything.
Was he responding?
He was responding in some. There were portions of it that weren't audible. We really couldn't get a clear indication of what was going on inside there, but he could squeeze Officer Herman's hand, and they could hear him trying to talk, but it was very mumbled. Officer Herman was trying to open the driver's side door, but actually it was locked, and searching through the water, he couldn't find anywhere to release the lock. Mm-hmm. So we were going to try and break out the driver's side window and maybe pull him through there. So I had gotten a window punch, and I shed my gear, dropped my belt, and jumped in the water. And as I swam out to them, I ended up swimming in the front portion of the cab where the front windshield area would be. It was actually submerged, so we didn't realize it till I started treading water. I actually put my foot right through an opening that was where the windshield once was. Found out that the whole windshield had been broken out. I kind of put my lower torso through the opening and felt around with my feet to see how large it was. And I could tell it was a pretty significant opening that I could fit my entire body through. I managed to shimmy my legs over to where Officer Herman had his arms reached through. I asked him if he could feel my feet to see if we had maybe a clear shot to where Dwayne was, and he grabbed hold of my feet, and he actually put it up to where Dwayne could grab onto my foot. At that time, Deputy Burdess tried to communicate with him. We thought maybe if he could just kind of use my body as a rope and climb out from where he was and mm-hmm. just climb me to the surface. We tried communicating that with him. There were a couple times where we weren't sure if we maybe had lost him. We lost communication. We weren't able to really get hold of him. So as things kind of got more critical, we just started discussing what we needed to do. I think it was Officer Herman said, I think one of us is going to have to go in there. I told him I'm already halfway there, so I would do it. I told him I was going to get turned around. I was going to, as I dove in, I was going to dive through the broken windshield and have Officer Herman take my hand and help guide me to the air pocket that Dwayne was in.
And he is in the air pocket, just to, so again, we have this picture. The cab is submerged, but there's a portion of the sleeper that has an air pocket where the victim was breathing.
Yes.
You've got to get through the cab to the sleeper to be where he is in that air pocket.
Yes.
What did you find when you dove into that?
So I took a deep breath. I closed my eyes. I felt around. I was able to grab Officer Herman's hand pretty quick. He helped guide me right to where Dwayne was. I think I grabbed onto his pant leg. I pulled myself up into his air pocket. I actually told him who I was. It was completely pitch black. I couldn't see anything. So I asked him if he was injured, if he was stuck on anything. He said he didn't think that he was. Said he really didn't know how deep he was, and he was pretty nervous on trying to make the swim out. I told him that I wasn't a very tall guy. I'm about 5'6", and my feet were hanging out of the front of the windshield, so we only had about 5-6 feet to go. He was still pretty hesitant. He was pretty labored in his breathing. The oxygen there was really not very good. It smelled like gasoline, diesel fuel, and it was just really bad air. So he kind of wanted to wait, but I told him we needed to go now. Told him to take a couple deep breaths, try and get himself a little bit oxygenated. I told him once we did that, we're going to take one deep breath. I'm going to pound 3 times on the cab. And that's going to be the signal. Officer Herman and Deputy Burdess had made their way to the front. They were actually holding on to my feet at that point. And the idea was I was going to knock, and they were going to just pull my feet, and I was going to hold on to Dwayne and kind of just make a little chain, and they were going to pull us both out of there.
Did it work according to plan?
It did, yep. I told them I'm going to take one deep breath. I'm going to pound 3 times, and we're going to go, and we did. And I pounded 3 times and started to shimmy out, and those guys yanked on my feet, and they pulled us all out. So we popped up to the surface. There was actually a tree branch that had kind of wedged its way in between the bridge and the bank that we were kind of using for stabilization, and we kind of all just leaned up against that. I don't know, it was probably almost a minute while we just kind of stood there breathing the air. Colfax Fire Department and Rescue were right there on the bank ready to scoop us all out of the water.
Do you remember if you exchanged any words right as you got out of there?
Yeah, I think I said, Dwayne, it's good to actually see.
You hadn't seen him up to that point.
No.
What was he saying? What was his face saying, or what was he saying with words?
Disoriented. I don't remember his exact words. I think he said he didn't really, wasn't too glad to be in that whole situation, something along those lines. So we were able to get him over to the bank, and gosh, the Colfax Rescue was right on. They had the board down there, got him strapped up, and I think he was on his way to Des Moines before we even got out of the water. So
he had some injuries, but survived it, of course. And do you keep in contact with him? Do you know how he's doing today?
We actually met him at Heroes of the Heartland banquet, and everything was going really well. One of the really cool things before that, a week or two, I think it was, after the accident, he and his family met with all of us and the Colfax Fire Department and the ambulance crew at the Jasper County Sheriff's Office, and we all kind of got to meet each other outside of the whole scene area and see how everybody was, and he was doing pretty good. He was still a little sore at that point. The whole family was very thankful for our efforts and what we were able to accomplish that day. So it was definitely a very cool experience to meet all of them.
In your time in law enforcement, had you ever done anything like that before, taken that sort of risk?
Not really, no. That was definitely a unique experience.
You and the two others are being honored as heroes. You feel yourself a hero? It certainly seems like you are.
You know, I think it's I think it's just us doing our job. I don't think where it was more of an extraordinary day, I think. I think that's just what we need to do as law enforcement officers. You know, we're there to serve the public as best we can, and I think that's what we try to accomplish. And I don't know, I think if it wasn't us three, it would have been another three. I know most of the guys in the county, and I know any one of them would have been equally as capable. So I don't think we did anything that anybody else in our position wouldn't have.
Baxter Police Officer Joe Bartello, congratulations again for being honored by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa as one of the 2014 Heroes of the Heartland. We appreciate you telling us the story and do appreciate your service to all Iowans.
Well, thank you.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, honoring heroes of the heartland. At least one child dies from choking on food every 5 days in the U.S. More than 10,000 children are taken to an emergency room each year for food choking injuries. Joshua Little of the town of Soldier in western Iowa was 9 years old and a student in his elementary school last year when he noticed a friend was choking. Joshua joins us now by phone. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
Take us back to the moment in the lunchroom when you first noticed that your friend Dylan was in trouble.
He was just eating like normal, but he had a little, like, cough. But I noticed that he wasn't just coughing, he was choking. So I just hit him on the back and gave him some back blows.
Was he asking for help? Was he making noises? Did he look distressed?
Yeah.
Could he speak?
No, not really.
How did you know what to do?
It's just a natural reaction.
So did something come flying out? Did he cough? What happened?
Yeah, he started to spit up a little bit, but it was like a biscuit and gravy.
Biscuit and gravy. What were the others doing at the lunch table while this was happening?
Just acting normal and everything. I think I was the only one that really noticed at the time.
And you called for help, I understand.
I just started to, like, get a couple of people. Like, I just, like we're supposed to raise our hands, so I went and did that, so they came running over and stuff.
What did Dylan say to you afterward, after you helped him out?
Well, he didn't. After I helped him and everything, he didn't really talk because he had to go to the hospital to make sure everything was out and stuff.
How are the others in the school reacting to that? Are you the hero of the school now?
I can't really say yes or no, but...
Uh-huh. It probably feels a little funny, huh, to be recognized as a hero?
Yeah.
Joshua Little, congratulations on this honor. And I understand while you were 9 years old when this happened, you just turned 10 years old this week.
Yes.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
What was the highlight of your birthday?
Probably just having everybody there and opening the present.
Josh Little, thank you for telling us the story and congratulations again on being recognized as an American Red Cross Hero of the Heartland for 2014.
Hey, thank you.
When we come back, more stories about heroes from the heartland. When we return, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, we're talking with ordinary people who've done extraordinary things. They're being honored by the Red Cross of Greater Iowa as Heroes of the Heartland. In July of 2013, Ashley Hale Smith was driving home from work on Highway 163 near Fairfield when she witnessed an accident and sprang into action. Ashley Hale-Smith joins us now. Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
You were driving home from work last year, and what happened?
We just come down the road, and there looked like there was a big dust ball, like somebody maybe was brush cutting like the roadways, and I got closer and noticed a semi had blown out two tires and rolled into the ditch.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? Did you pull over immediately next to it, or...?
I stayed back behind it quite a ways and pulled over, put my blinkers on, and ran up there. And as I got there, it was on its side, and it was the husband and the wife. the wife was on the underneath part where it had rolled over, and noticed that the engine was starting to catch on fire. The gentleman handed me a fire extinguisher out the window, and I proceeded to put out the fire and then helped him and his wife out of the vehicle.
So the victims were Mandy Edwards and Scott Edwards were in this. What was the scene like? Were they as calm as it sounds?
He was pretty calm. She wasn't so calm. I think she had really bad anxiety, which, you know, you don't blame her for what she had just
of
went
course.
Through and everything.
They're in shock, no doubt. Handed you
yes.
the fire extinguisher. How big were the flames at that point?
They weren't very big. It was just kind of small flames, nothing too big.
So you are waiting for the ambulance, the emergency services to arrive. What happened then? Are they both trapped in the overturned truck?
He ended up kicking out the front windshield of the semi to get him and her out. I helped get her out. We then walked her over, sat her down, and I continued just to stay behind her and stabilize her neck. And then they helped with the husband, and he came over and sat beside her, too, just to kind of help calm her down from all the things that they had been through previous.
How did you know to stabilize her neck?
Say 7 years ago, when I first started working, I worked at Davis County Hospital in Bloomfield, and I started on the emergency department and on the ambulance, so I've had a background in it.
Mm. Later, Mandy Edwards wrote the following about this incident. My husband is Scott Edwards. We were involved in a rollover accident in Iowa. We would like to thank those who assisted. One lady named Ashley stayed with me the whole time and stabilized my neck. Thanks to her, I am not paralyzed because my neck was broken. That's pretty amazing that you helped that.
I was just, I'm always willing to do anything to help. I say I love helping people, and I'm just glad I could be in the right place at the right time that day to help them.
Okay. Many people thankful for that. Ashley, thank you for telling us the story of your part in being a hero of the Heartland as recognized by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa. We'll let you go, Ashley. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Last September, during a standoff in Rockwell City, 37-year-old Officer Jamie Bunting was shot and killed in the line of duty. Bunting had worked in law enforcement since 1999. He is survived by his wife and two children. Corey Trott has been charged with first-degree murder for Officer Bunting's death. Last month, Officer Bunting was posthumously awarded as Hero of the Heartland by the Red Cross. Rockwell Police Chief Larry Shoup joins us now to remember Officer Bunting. Chief Shoup, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
I understand because of the upcoming trial, you can't share with us any further circumstances of Officer Bunting's death, but we would like to learn a little bit about his life and his service. What kind of man was Jamie Bunting?
He was a great guy. He had a lot of friends, knew a lot of people. He was a great husband, a loving father. He was very busy. He liked to keep active. He was an outdoorsman. He liked to hunt, fish. Shoot. He was a firearms instructor. He taught a lot of concealed weapons permit classes and met a lot of people from around the state and even outside the state teaching those classes. Heard a lot of good feedback about his classes. Very knowledgeable, and he was there for everybody.
Mm-hmm. How long had you known Jamie Bunting?
I've known him for a long time. His father was the chief of police in Pomeroy for quite a few years,
mm-hmm.
And that's how I got to know him originally, so it was quite a few years.
Law enforcement ran in the family then?
Yes.
Line-of-duty deaths are unique situations in emergency services. Tell us how this affected the community of law enforcement people and the people of Rockwell City.
It was a huge heartbreak. I mean, he was one of us. It's a big brotherhood. The whole community, I'll tell you what, they were great. They all came together, and outpours of support, concern, just everybody wanting to know that they were there for the family and for our department, and it was just a great, great thing.
I understand, in addition, Officer Bunting served as a member on a regional special emergency response team. What's involved with that? What is that for?
Just for situations like this, serving high-risk warrants, standoffs. You know, they get called out when we need special officers to assist in different investigations.
Chief Shoup, what will Jamie Bunting be most remembered for by the department?
Just his smile and his, I mean, you always knew that he was there for you, whatever you needed.
Rockwell City Police Chief Larry Shoup, thank you very much for this remembrance.
You're welcome.
Now, most of the noteworthy acts of this year's 21 Everyday Heroes Award honorees took place within the last year or have been part of an ongoing volunteer effort. But 85-year-old Bob Westermeyer's story is a little different. It goes back over 70 years. It was a Saturday night in April of 1938 when Bob Westermeyer, was just 10 and a half years old. He was home babysitting his five younger siblings when a fire broke out. Joining us now to talk about that fateful night, Timothy Westermeyer, the son of Bob Westermeyer. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
This is a story that permeates your family. A lot of people are grateful for what your father did here, and I'm sure you've heard the story many times. Take us back to that night.
Okay, it was a night, April 6, 1938, when my grandmother, Linus, or grandmother Charlotte and Linus, Westermeyer decided to leave and go up to their mother and father's on 17th Street in Dubuque for a visit. So they put my dad, Robert, in charge of the family, basically to watch the kids and make sure they got to bed on time and all that other stuff.
And at the age of 11, he's the oldest one, right?
Yeah, my father was, at that time, was 10 and a half years old. This is in April 6th. Of 38, and his birthday is in September, and he would be 11 in September. He started watching the kids, got them all in bed, and around 12 o'clock in the morning, he was awoken by either the smell or gagging or coughing and jumped up out of bed and suddenly realized that the room was engulfed in a lot of smoke. And he made his way over to the top of the stairway and started hollering for the rest of the siblings. The other five siblings, Frederick, which was the youngest at three, and then Mary Ellen, Ronnie, Jerry, and Katie, all up ages from 3, 4, 6, 7, and 9, were awoken, and Dad got them up and got them gathered up to the top of the stairway and made their way down the stairway to the front door and outside, where they saw neighbors out there that already had called the fire department, and Grandma and Grandpa were already been called to come back at that night.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically his part of what he did, and we feel very proud that he had done that and gotten all my aunts and uncles out safely without harm.
Did that fire engulf the entire house? What was left of the house?
The fire department got there, got most of it put out. It was totally destroyed on the inside. There was one refrigerator that they had that was still working yet, I guess. That kind of made the newspaper. Anyway, yes, the main part of the fire was totally destroyed the house on the inside.
So there was would have been no doubt what would have happened to the five children had your father not woken his siblings.
Right. If he wouldn't have woke when he did, everybody probably would have got smoke inhalation and probably would have suffocated and died. Like I said, I'm very grateful and proud of my dad. What he had done.
Mm-hmm. How often is this talked about at family gatherings?
Well, Dad don't look at it as being something that he did heroic. He just looks at it like, you know, it was my job to babysit, my job to watch the kids, and I did what I had to do to get those kids out of the house safely. And he doesn't really look at it, you know, like he did something important.
Mm-hmm. You nominated your dad as an everyday hero over 70 years ago this happened. So tell us that story. Why did you decide to do that when it's actually often these heroes are for more recent occurrences?
a few years ago, they had this honor flight, and I felt it was time that, you know, he would be recognized for his service in Korea. So I also nominated him to get on the honor flight, and we got that all set up and got him and myself to go to Washington for that. You know, and I felt, you know, Mom was always talking about how he got the report, or he got the Purple Heart and some awards in the service, but never got the medals. She got a hold of Senator Tom Harkin's office here in Iowa, and with the several letters she wrote, Senator Tom Harkin's office finally got those medals that he had deserved, the Purple Heart, from the Korean War, which was 50-some years later. Hearing that story and a few other ones, you know, I kind of wanted to keep the ball rolling and do the honor flight, and then I thought of this thing that they always talked about, too, that maybe he should deserve a little honor for that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what inspired me to come up with this.
Have you figured out in rough terms, in rough numbers?
You know, like I said, if Dad wouldn't have made it out, you know, we probably wouldn't have been born. And close to 20, 25 people would have been affected. And then it escalates back down to our grandkids and everything, also, you know, our kids.
Tim Westermeyer, what a wonderful story. And thank you for bringing it forward so that we can all be inspired by it.
Thank you very much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our focus today, the American Red Cross's 2014 Heroes of the Heartland. These are ordinary people in our community who've done extraordinary things in our state, in our communities, listening to stories that inspire us. And this hour, we're finding out about the stories behind some of this year's heroes. On July 31st of last year, 2013, Chris Eiley of Ames came across a car that was caught on railroad tracks. And, you guessed it, a train was coming. Chris Eiley joins me now from his office in the mortgage department of Wells Fargo in Ames. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So take us back to July 31st of 2013. How did you come to be at this rail crossing? It was in Ames?
Yeah, it was just a normal day, and I was just coming back from my lunch break, and as I was pulling into the parking lot of the bank, I noticed that a car was still on the railroad tracks. I thought, oh my gosh!
You know, and you noticed there were people
license plates. Mm-hmm. He had a neck brace on, and I thought, well, these people need to get that car off the railroad tracks. But I just kind of went about my business, went over, and I parked my motorcycle, and I look up, and they're still on the railroad tracks. I'm thinking, oh, boy, all right, well, they should probably move. And then just as I was thinking that, I saw or heard the train coming from another intersection, and they were it was coming this way. So I just I threw my sunglasses down, my keys, and I ran over there, and I started pushing on the back of their car. And the problem was is that night I was going to go see Dwight Yoakam in concert, and so I was wearing cowboy boots, and I couldn't get any traction, you know, with cowboy boots on pavement. And so I couldn't get the car moved. So then I had to run around to the front of the car. So I could wedge my boots in between the indentures of the railroad tracks. And just as I was able to push the car back, I was able to kind of squeeze myself in between the car and the train that had just passed.
Mm. So how close was it?
I mean, seconds, you know, feet. You know, I was worried about the back of my feet getting hit by the train. As I was pushing on the car, you know, to get it rolled back, I always felt like at any time I could have, you know, lunged my chest onto the hood of the car.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I was worried about the back of my feet getting hit by the train. It was close.
And who were the people inside the car?
It was an elderly couple from Slater, Iowa. And, you know, they're just, you know, Iowans. And so, you know, they had a car and, you know, they just figured it was going to eventually turn over because they were trying to start the car the whole time. And, you know, it's just kind of the way Iowans are. You know, we always think our cars are going to start. And, you know, and if they don't, you know, we or somebody else will come along and push it off the side of the road. So it was just kind of a kind of a normal Iowa reaction, I think, on both of our parts. That you thought the car was going to start, and if the car don't start, you push off the side of the road and you work on it.
But they were aware that a train was bearing down on them.
They were such in shock. I mean, it was, they were pretty much deer in headlights, you know, and he had a neck brace on, so he really couldn't turn to see the train. So to be honest, I don't think they really fully understood the danger that they were in at the time. And I don't even think they realized it, you know, after the fact, you know, when people were, you know, helping them get out of the car. I just don't think that they knew.
You have to shudder to think what would have happened had you not been there to move the car.
The train was obviously trying to stop. I mean, you could hear the brakes being applied, and you could hear that screaming. You know, I could look up and I saw the engineer waving, you know, everybody to get out of the way. And so it was a scary, scary time. And then when the train eventually did come to a stop, you know, traffic was backed up and nobody knew what happened. And it was just, you know, my legs were shaking. And so I didn't know what to do. And so I walked back into work and, I just poured myself a cup of coffee and I called my dad. I'm like, dude, you're not going to believe what just happened to me. And so we really didn't know what to do. And so, and then ever since then, you know, it's just been, you know, a whirlwind of people that, you know, want to talk to you about what happened, you know, what you were thinking and what you were going to do. And I'm telling you, it's been really amazing because you meet, you know, when something like that happens to you, you know, there's two kinds of people that, that reach out to you. You know, it's people that have similar stories or that people, you know, would do the exact same thing. And so either way, those are people that you want to talk with and hang out with. So through this experience, you know, I have just met the most amazing, interesting people.
There have been some studies on this. I wonder if you looked into this about when and why people will risk their own life for the life of a stranger or strangers in this case.
I just think I'm young enough and I'm dumb enough to think that I could have moved a car in time in front of a train. And so, you know, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to be in shape and strong enough where, you know, I think if anybody had my natural ability, they would have done the exact same thing.
Yeah, but did you realize the danger you were in at that time?
I knew it was crazy when it was happening, but no, I really didn't think too much about it.
Mm-hmm. So you said you were right afterwards, the train stops, it passes, it comes within inches of you. You are safe. The couple in the car is safe. And you walk back into Wells Fargo where you work and without having talked to the couple in the car?
No, because they were pretty shaken up. And so they even had a hard time getting out of the car. And so people that were in their cars who saw it all go down, at that point, that, you know, they've now gotten out of their cars and they were kind of helping them get out. And I just thought, man, you know, my legs were already shaken and I didn't know what to say. I was scared. And so, I just went back into work, like I said, and I just let them kind of handle with, you know, the aftermath of it. I just kind of felt like, well, I did my part. I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this honor, the American Red Cross 2014 Hero of the Heartland?
Well, I mean, it's humbling. I mean, oh, my gosh, you know, the things that other people do. I mean, like I said, they're really heroes in terms of, you know, the volunteering work and the differences that they make on people's everyday. I was just, you know, a one-shot deal where, you know, I was just at the right place at the right time. I mean, the police officers and, you know, in Des Moines and the teachers, I mean, they're the real heroes. It's like I said, I'm just dumb enough to think that I could have done it and was lucky enough to have.
Chris Eiley works in the mortgage department of Wells Fargo in Ames, and he has been recognized by the American Red Cross. Heroes of the Heartland, the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, the hour has come to an end, and that's unfortunate because there are so many more Heroes of the Heartland whose stories we didn't get to, like Angela Albers, who, after experiencing the struggle of being a foster parent herself, started Drops of Hope. That's an outreach organization to encourage foster care. Calvetta Williams, who was moved by the death of a close friend to start Mothers Against Violence, or Mike Brinkman, who took quick action in June of 2013 when a customer at the Menards store where he worked went into cardiac arrest. Bob Schlager, who started the Midwest Youth Football League, that was back in the year 2000, and Afghanistan combat veteran James J.T. Thomas, who uses his own experience with post-traumatic stress disorder to help others find hope and assistance. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. If you missed part of this show and would like to hear the entire hour or any of our other hours, they're all put up on our website to listen to as podcasts or streaming audio. Simply go to iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.